Hello and welcome back to another day here at the Damage Report. It's a Wednesday, which means one thing. Halfway to the weekend. Oh, you thought I was talking about JR, who's also here. How's it going, JR?
What's up? What's up? I didn't get a chance to get on much this morning and start pushing JR Wednesday and do that incessant hashtagging and obnoxious promoting myself. So, you know, I'm gonna make it up to you guys. I want to make sure you guys know that I connect with this gaming audience, you Dragon Squad members, that I'm very proud to have been donned a name. I'm gonna join you guys in the way you guys do things. Look, I'm now in a video game. I don't know which one, but I'm sure you guys will like it.
I'm gonna say, is that the Outer Wilds? I'm not sure, or Outer Worlds. Anyway, I'm glad to have you here. Yeah, I forgot to tweet about the show too, because I was doing my live stream. It's like I couldn't do the social media thing because I was doing a social media thing. Oh, the modern day. By the way, can I mention one thing? Oh, look at that. This is the pandemic. We can't see each other, but we have worm backgrounds. Anyway. Let me mention something about social media that bothers me before we get into the important news of the day. So one thing that's always bothered me on Twitter, one of the scariest things when you click on someone's account, especially a famous person, and you see the number of people they follow and it's like 50,000, it always makes me just stop and wonder what resulted in that. But you know what's worse, I think? I'm not gonna say who this is, but I clicked on someone's profile. And you know how like you can retweet things, right? Uh-huh. And so technically you can retweet yourself and people do it from time to time. I get it. But when you click on an account and they have retweeted every single one of their tweets as you scroll through it, that shouldn't be allowed and it shouldn't be abided and something should be done about it because that just says so much. Anyway,
it shouldn't be abided. Wow, John.
It shouldn't be abided. The president should do something about it. Anyway, okay, so no, Brett, it's actually not. I mean, not to say that it's not, but it's not who I'm talking about. Anyway, okay, so thank you to everybody who's already here. You've joined us to talk about worm backgrounds and social media faux pas, and you'll get more of it, but you'll also probably get some politics. And as we go along, please hit the like button if you haven't already so that people know that we're live and they can join us in this little conversation. And as we conversate, JR and I will be responding along the way. We want to know your thoughts about these stories that we've selected for you. By the way, if you don't know this, maybe you've just been watching the Damage Report full show during the pandemic or whatever. We've started doing a pre-show. It usually starts about 45 minutes before the show on YouTube. So if you have notifications turned on for the YouTube channel, you'll get those. And we talk about other stories that couldn't quite make it onto the show, but are always a lot of fun. So stay tuned for that. It happens most days. And if there's a day where it's not gonna happen, you will get no warning whatsoever. That is my pledge to you. But anyway, with that, why don't we jump into the news?
I'm ready.
Donald Trump lost the presidential election in Georgia. He's lost it multiple times and he's getting ready to lose it again because they're doing a full manual recount of millions of votes. That is not going to change the result. But what it does do is offer a lot of opportunity for Donald Trump and other crazy people to make the lives a living hell for all of the people involved in that process. We want to talk about one of those people. This is Gabriel Sterling, works for the Georgia Secretary of State, a conservative Republican for literally his entire life, so far as we know, who's involved in this recount. And he's been getting a lot of death threats. People he knows and cares about have been getting a lot of death threats around this. And so here was his plea to the president and Republicans to knock it off.
It has all gone too far. All of it. Joe DeGeneva today asked for Chris Krebs, a patriot who ran CISA, to be shot. A 20-something tech in Gwinnett County today has death threats and a noose put out saying he should be hung for treason because he was transferring a report on batches from an EMS to a county computer so he could read it. It has to stop. Mr. President, you have not condemned these actions or this language. Senators, you have not condemned this language or these actions. This has to stop. We need you to step up, and if you're going to take a position of leadership, show some. My boss, Secretary Raffensperger, his address is out there. They have people doing caravans in front of their house. They've had people come onto their property. Trisha, his wife of 40 years, is getting sexualized threats through her cell phone. It has to stop. This is elections. This is the backbone of democracy. And all of you who have not said a damn word are complicit in this. Mr. President, it looks like you likely lost the state of Georgia. We're investigating. There's always a possibility. I get it. And you have the rights to go through the courts. What you don't have the ability to do, and you need to step up and say this, is stop inspiring people to commit potential acts of violence. Someone's going to get hurt. Someone's going to get shot. Someone's going to get killed. And it's not right.
Okay, so that is a conservative Republican worried that he might be killed, someone else involved in this might be killed. A noose was left on someone who'd been involved in the election on their stoop by someone from QAnon. And so he is just calling on other Republicans, or ideally the president, who's been pushing all this misinformation and demonizing them, to stop before someone gets killed. And that message was received by the president, who quote retweeted it with this understanding message intended to take down the temperature of the room. Rigged election, show signatures and envelopes, expose the massive voter fraud in Georgia. What is Secretary of State and Brian Kemp afraid of? They know what we'll find. That's good. So you watched the video and you got the message asking for you to stop before somebody is killed, and you implied that they're hiding something to steal the election from you.
The direct response to this video. Direct response to what?
Well, retweeting that video.
Yeah, to what Gabriel Sterling had to say directly. Not that we can take into account that he's probably responding to it because he didn't mention the person's name, or maybe it's what are those called? Shadow tweeting, or what's it called? Ghost tweeting? I don't know what it is. When you don't mention the person you're tweeting. It's not any of that.
No, that's when you identify that they're doing it. Yeah, I don't know.
We're so old. So it's not even the speculation, it's direct. It's here, let me repost this of someone saying, hey, maybe you should step up and tell people who are supporting you that are threatening to kill people who are counting the votes. Maybe tell them to stop doing that. And your response is, what are you afraid of? Maybe what they're afraid of is murder. Maybe death. Maybe they don't know what happens in the afterlife. Maybe they don't. Maybe they have a wife and kids. Maybe they're 21 years old and they have their entire life to live. Maybe they enjoy their lives. Whatever it is they have to fear, it's death. Mm-hmm. Same thing that you feared, Trump. So it's this whole like just don't care. It doesn't. Honestly, I'm not sure if you watched it or even looked at that tweet. It's let me respond to something that's getting some attention and continue my same grift, continue my same yelling into the ether about unfair election fraud, 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 fraud. Here's another chance to say fraud. I don't care what actually I'm responding to. Let's just say more fraud. What are you afraid of?
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, they're afraid of being attacked. They're afraid of being killed. I don't know that she's a Republican, but the likely Republican wife of the Republican Secretary of State of Georgia is having rape threats. And the bad people in this story, according to the president, are the people receiving the rape and death threats, because he wants to get something out of this. He knows it's not going to be an election win. It's something else. It's ratings for his network later, or it's more money being donated to his recount fund or whatever. He has got to get his money. And if that means someone gets shot or someone gets raped, it ain't him. So why would he care about that? And again, in the same way that like, I get that nothing gets through to anyone, but there sometimes are things like it seems where they should. Like when Fox was trying to get their viewers killed all year long, including tonight with COVID, by telling them to not take it seriously. Like shouldn't, when the people you watch are trying to kill you, shouldn't that get through? Like if I were to tell the Dragon Squad is watching this right now to go walk blindfolded in traffic, shouldn't they stop watching? But apparently it didn't work for the Republicans. And in this case, where he's attacking Republicans, but it doesn't get through because these people are hungry for the drama and the best kind of drama. There's some different good kinds of drama. One is you being a victim. People love that. The other is these other people that you thought were on your side are actually traitors. That's tasty to them. They love the idea that he's attacking a Republican because those Republicans aren't good enough, the ones he's attacking.
Well, and also you have to actually answer for things that you said before. If, you know, there's always the disarming argument in politics, and this is done on both sides. Whenever someone of the opposite party agrees with you, you'll say, even this guy and who agrees with, who normally agrees with you, agrees with me. So therefore you should be quiet. A lot of times that approach doesn't help, because then what, they'll just start calling the person a dino or a rhino, and then say that they're just doing this for political points, and maybe there's another reasons why behind it. And many times that could be it. But this particular thing, the truth is right in front of folks, and some people like this guy in Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, who's a ardent Trump supporter, mentioned it many times, donated to him, campaigned for him, endorsed him, all that stuff. I don't know if he campaigned for him, but endorsed him, all that stuff happened, and he still isn't good enough. It's just and also this guy speaking out isn't enough to convince others that, oh, he's just a rhino. Oh, he's just, this guy's just mad because they're speaking the facts. And this is one of those rare instances when the reason that they're opposing you is because the facts just aren't on your side.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I'm hoping like the recount will be done relatively soon. The Electoral College is gonna vote within a couple of weeks. It'll be certified by on January 6th. Maybe we will get through all of that with only our faith in our democracy being shredded and it being set up for future elections where Republicans are never going to accept that they've lost. Maybe that'll be the only damage. Won't we be lucky then? Or maybe Gabriel Sterling will be shot, or maybe someone will be raped, or maybe someone's house will be set on fire because these people are crazy. And we're just hoping that the craziness, which has been getting worse and worse every day of all of this hysteria, will all of a sudden just go away once their hope is gone. Like once the Electoral College votes, once it's certified, once the inauguration, well, surely all of the murderous crazies will just go back to watching like Schitt's Creek or something at that point. That's what we're supposed to hope for at this point. And honestly, like I get it. There are some people who are just like, it's so crazy, it can't possibly work. Surely we'll be okay. That's fine. There's other people, I'm just gonna say it. Like, people like Glenn Greenwald, who are like joking about the fact that people were worried about Trump overthrowing the results of the election on Twitter. Like, ha ha, look at these people getting hysterical about somebody trying to overthrow democracy. He's still doing it. He's threatening Republicans' lives. And it is definitely going to come back in every election from now on. The idea that that would be a joke just doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. And this, yeah, like, okay, I'm a crazy lefty or whatever, but there are Republicans worried about being murdered right now as this is going on. It's not a joke to them. It's not a joke to Gabriel Sterling or Spanberger's wife. This is not funny to them.
Oh, and by the way, first, John, I doubt any of Trump's militia folks who are trying to implement violence have watched any episode of Schitt's Creek, number one. Number two.
That's probably true. That's just what I thought of.
I know.
I barely watch it, honestly.
Number two, if you think about the folks like Trump, you remember Kathy Griffin was virtually blackballed from Hollywood because of the severed head picture that she posted early on in his presidency, never to be seen or heard from again. Oh my God, that's the worst thing ever. And then the congressional baseball practice that got shot up by the I don't remember the guy's name. So shot up and shot at Republicans specifically. They were so outraged. How could they do this? Oh my God, good thing the Capitol Police and security was there because they could have killed us. What are you guys gonna do about it? Hey, Bernie Sanders, you gonna say something? Now imagine if Bernie Sanders then came out after you had all these things on Twitter that you said about that and went, well, maybe you shouldn't be outside. Hey, well, maybe you should pass some things that American people like. Imagine if he said that.
Oh my God. Because
that's not even the equivalent of Trump doing this. If Bernie Sanders said that, he'd at least be talking about policy that many Americans are in support of. What you're saying is that there's this fascination with this fraudulent election that you keep pushing as saying fraudulent. That's what you're pushing when it comes to people throwing out death threats. If there's another attack on people who are elected officials, and another person actually said, maybe you should start doing something for the American people, you'd be outraged. And rightfully so, because you shouldn't endorse things like that, honestly. Yeah. But you will, and then we'll continue to have this fight back and forth where one side gives in, the other side encourages it.
Yeah. And Bernie had said,
imagine.
What are you hiding? Oh my God. But for Trump, that's his fourth worst tweet that day.
And then
we're not even like focusing on the fact that he pardoned. Yeah, exactly. Like he pardoned Mike Flynn. And what's one of the first things Mike Flynn does is he tweets out a manifesto calling for the military to overturn the results of the election and conduct their own election. He's calling for a military coup that theoretically would keep the same president in order. This is not usually the way that comes, that it goes. But that's just, you know, it's not, it's even news, really. We're not even covering it today on the show.
It's what a patriot would do, though, John.
Exactly.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
So we've been wondering about Donald Trump's pardon power. Who is he going to pardon? Will it be him and his family? Definitely. But who else? And apparently, while we've been interested in this, the Justice Department has been looking into it as well, because they have apparently for some time been investigating a bribery scheme that directed money to the White House or used political contributions in exchange for a presidential pardon. The district court in Washington, D.C. released 20 pages of heavily redacted documents that do not identify who is being investigated, nor the timing of the alleged scheme. Now, like we have in that document, we don't know a ton specifically about what happened. So it's difficult as an outsider to say how serious this is, how likely it is that this was actually going on and that people were gonna pay Trump to pardon them. We do have one extra piece of evidence though, and that is this tweet about Donald Trump in regards to this news. It says, "Pardon investigation is fake news." So I'm thinking maybe it's real. I'm thinking maybe they're onto something.
So the pardon investigation is fake news. Is the news of the pardon investigation fake, or is the investigation into all of these double backdoor dealings, is that the fake part? Which one is fake? You know, it's a tweet that can kind of encompass the whole thing. Is the news fake? Because fake news is now this term. It's not, this news is fake about this pardon investigation. Therefore, what's real about that investigation then? Mm-hmm. Is it real that they're doing it and it's over? I'm not sure which aspect here. It doesn't matter. Again, back to referring to the first tweet that he had in that first story we just did. It doesn't matter what the tweet is. It doesn't matter what the story is. Just say what you always say and just put it out on Twitter. It doesn't have to make sense.
I think it's all fake. I think the Justice Department doesn't actually exist. Whatever needs to be fake for him to feel comfortable is what's fake. So let me give you a little bit more details about this. Prosecutors asked the court for permission to review email communications they believe revealed a quote, bribery conspiracy scheme in which redacted would offer a substantial political contribution in exchange for a presidential pardon or reprieve of sentence for redacted. A filter team working on behalf of the government was going through several terabytes of data they had seized from over 50 electronic devices, such as iPhones, iPads, laptops, thumb drives, hard drives, one Microsoft Zune. Now, unfortunately, there's all of those devices and all of this data, but none of them were found in a pawn shop. So Fox isn't gonna care about this. It's not gonna be a serious story that they need to cover. You notice, by the way, they're not talking about that laptop anymore. What happened
Absolutely.
To that? Wasn't that big news? You don't care about it anymore.
I think those caravans from South America, Central America, and Mexico took the laptops and took them back home. Those same caravans we stopped hearing about in the midterm elections, those same ones that disappeared into the ether, that's where the laptop went.
Yeah. Now, additional information, investigators suspect that the convict seeking the pardon was imprisoned as recently as this summer and that two people working on behalf of the convict may have undertaken a secret lobbying campaign by approaching White House officials, according to the documents. We do have a comment from an anonymous government official who says no government official was or is currently a subject or target of the investigation disclosed in this filing. I don't really understand how that could be. Like theoretically, like, oh, maybe they didn't do anything wrong, but they were apparently approached by someone outside of government to do this. But anyway, JR, let me ask you, let me say something and you give me your opinion. Maybe this is controversial and understand it's not gonna be immediately clear what I mean by this, but is this illegal? Is it? Like, if someone were to offer him money to pardon them,
yes.
Is that illegal? I honestly don't know.
My name is not Adrian Lawrence, no. But I'm gonna go on the my legal degree that I got from my garage and say that, yeah, I mean, it kind of has to be, right? If you're a criminal and then you offer up, you know, what campaign contributions, and so that's literal cash, because especially when it comes to campaign contributions to this president, it doesn't go to campaigns, that goes to him. So anyway, that's direct money to him. Offering up money to a president to use his position to get you off of a crime? Just think about it, it has to be illegal. If it's not, I mean, just find yourself a couple good friends that have some kind of power and then just go on a crime spree, I guess.
Yeah.
Although that's kind of what the Trump administration decided to do when they came into office.
I guess. Look, you know better than me. You've got your degree from Harvard Law, Total Landscaping. But anyway, the reason I say it is the pardon power is very bizarre. Let's just acknowledge that. It is effectively a constitution that was set up to not have a king, where like at one point they were just like, but let's give him one king thing. Let's let him do one thing that only kings can do. And let's make it really vague who you can give it to, for what. Like, why wouldn't he be able to get money? Like, what would he believe that they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart? It's all for their benefit. Yes, sometimes they go through at least the little bit of hand waving of the fact that it's a campaign donation, but that's just cash anyway. And by the way, look at the people he's already pardoned. Every one of those situations is demonstrably more corrupt than a check for $50,000.
Absolutely.
Roger Stone tried to help him win an election by coordinating with a foreign power, intimidating witnesses, threatening to kill people, I think threatening to kill a dog. And after he was pardoned, and he didn't give information specifically so that he would get the pardon. And then after he was pardoned, he goes back to threatening murder for the people who oppose the president and all that. How is that less corrupt than a $50,000 check or a $100,000 check or $1 million or whatever? The raw money, this is less a way to influence the president than what we just saw with Roger Stone or with Michael Flynn or whoever the next crony of his that broke the law to benefit Donald Trump that he's apparently fully legally able to pardon.
Apparently they're just trying to test the system, John. I mean, just like his lack of paying taxes, everything else. Hey, if you don't like the system, maybe you should change it. Until then, you can't get mad at people who use it. Again, I don't even know that they're using the system in some loophole in it to get by this. This can't be a normal thing. This can't be something that just gets accepted as let's just go on. And by the way, if it is, if it's something that our great nation and our infallible constitution has somehow overlooked, we can change it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people are speculating in the chat. Is it Joe Exotic? I don't know. I mean, who knows? Like, it could be some random person. Like, who's the Illinois politician? I always forget his name.
Blagojevich.
Blagojevich. There was Blagojevich, Arpaio. All of those are incredibly corrupt situations that make no sense. Like, the money thing would be at least more typical corruption. And it's not like Clinton was involved in ones that had to do with money. It just seems weird. I do think maybe, I doubt it because nothing matters. Maybe this being in the news during these last 49 days where Trump can use this pardon power might make him a little bit more hesitant to hand it out to people like his family or Giuliani. But that probably is expecting too much.
Oh, someone is speculating Ghislaine Maxwell.
Can you imagine if he pardoned Ghislaine Maxwell, like the QAnon like the thinking process they'd have to go through for that to not be a denunciation of everything they believe.
No, let's not forget though. Also, there was some kind words, or at least neutral words, then kind words said about her as well by the president. So, I mean, it could have been at that, again, we're gonna go with the speculation. None of this is confirmed. None of this is even has any reason for us to believe it. But you know, this the lobbying could have been happening and he could have been pondering it. And so he decided to say some neutral to favorable things about her. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe. Think about, like, just based off the two people we talked about today. For Ghislaine Maxwell, he's like, I wish her well. And all the Republicans are like, well, he's just wishing her well. He would wish anyone well. This Republican guy counting the vote, he's like, what are you hiding? I think Ghislaine Maxwell is hiding worse stuff, if I had to guess. Oh God, that should have been a moment for learning, but it was not. Anyway, let's turn to a little story that it's not huge news, but it really frustrates me in a lot of ways. And so let's jump into this. Barack Obama's out there on the interview circuit. Recently spoke to, I believe it was Peter Hamby of Vanity Fair. And their conversation was frustrating in a lot of different ways. The answers that Obama gave, very frustrating. And they've gotten some good responses from members of the squad and others. But then just the questions that Peter Hamby, the way he framed things to him. And I wanna give you, so here's what we're gonna have. We're gonna have a couple different interactions between Hamby and the president. We're gonna have the full question from Hamby and then the immediate response from Obama. So after the way that these questions are set up, I want you to see what he immediately responded with. So here's the first, this is Peter Hamby. So you write in the book, because they're talking about his most recent book, about how your grandmother instilled a certain worldview in you that you ended up taking into politics. Values like modesty, humility, hard work, marrying passion with reason. Today though, if you're becoming politically sentient on the internet, those aren't really values that apply. Are you worried that young people on the left today are engaging with politics in a way that is too combative? In ways that value attention and emotion, and that is kind of unhelpful for them as they enter politics and the political conversation. And Obama responds to all of that and says, well, you know, Malia and Sasha, my daughters, we talk about this. Now we're gonna have more of his answer. But that guy, Peter Hamby, just said these things like hard work, passion with reason, modesty, that's a thing of the past. Make political work great again. Now they don't have any of that. They're too combative and emotional.
So young people.
That is quite a framing.
Is this young elected officials, young like randos on Twitter, young voters? Like, which young people are you talking about? By the way, when you say something like young people politically, and you're talking to, of course, former President Obama, who's a Democrat, you're talking about young Democratic voters. You're talking about young progressives. Let's keep it real. There's lots of code words. You know, for the young voting bloc that the establishments of both parties dislike. And this is one of those moments when you talk to someone who's an established head of the party, you'll say something like, what do you think about the young voters? Well, how about that old voter or that old president in the White House right now in his 70s, who is the biggest of this that fits to a T exactly what you described. If you're gonna become relevant on the internet, which he says all the time, Twitter is my platform, it's the place where I can talk, it's where I can get my message out to my people. So let's keep it real, he's already pointed out that he uses Twitter and platforms of social media to push out his ridiculousness and his lies. We know that already. So that's the number one person we should be addressing when it comes to this, not young people who are on Twitter responding many times to what our government officials are doing to us.
Yeah, and we're just coming off an election where young people did turn out and voted for Biden. So was that good? Because those people suck. Those people are emotional and combative and that sort of, wait, so you wanna vote, you want them to vote for you, but you don't wanna listen to them and you don't want them to drive the conversation at all because it's so counterproductive and they're just trying to score points and everything.
Emotional so and combative. Let me give you a little
bit more emotional and combative.
Combative, yeah, cool, good.
And so, I mean, look, this is a year of massive protests and constant rallies and all of that. Well, are we supposed to believe that he's not talking about those people? Those things that have, like, they've been the big, other than the pandemic, that has been the story of American politics this year. Emotional, combative, not helpful really. So he says sometimes because you're responding so quickly and trying to be clever or snappy that they sometimes feel as if we're not really listening to each other as much as we should. We're just trying to score points. Okay, so this is a theme that's gonna come back a couple times during this thing about Obama, and that was Obama right there. So we're not really listening to each other as much as we should. We're just trying to score points. So here's the thing. Like, if there is any lesson to be learned from Obama's 8 years, what is that lesson? It is that trying to pointlessly talk to people and engage with people that have no interest in doing that is a fantastic way to spend 8 years accomplishing far less than you otherwise could have. Like, the passion, the combativeness of these stupid young people, in theory, could have had you use your supermajority in the Senate to get more than just the ACA done in effectively the 6 years where hypothetically there could have been some sort of legislation. But no, you tried to constantly engage with them and bring them in and be helpful and be reasonable and listen to their concerns. The negotiations for the ACA took more than a year because they kept doing these long rounds of negotiation where they gave more and more and more. And I understand some of the young people in the audience may not remember this. Do you know in the end how many Republican votes the ACA got? Zero after a year of negotiations. But coming out of this, he looks back on that time and thought, hey, at least we were talking. Now it's just combative. Well, no, but they were combative right then, and they kind of got what they wanted. They got an ACA that was weaker than it could have otherwise been. Yep. Because you listened to them, you paid attention to them, you prioritized them, not the progressives who are pushing for a stronger bill. A bill that would be better now, that wouldn't be as expensive now, that'd be more popular now. But instead you got something weaker, specifically because you elevated pointless bipartisanship that had no chance of succeeding over the actual needs of your constituents and the driving force of those who got you elected in the first place. Those same stupid, young, emotional voters who supported Barack Obama in 2008.
Yeah, we're just looking past each other and we're not finding anything to agree on. And we're just trying to score quick, cheap points. Again, that kind of characterization is only getting laid upon one side. There's no way you're saying that Republicans are just trying to score cheap political points by throwing out one-liners and trying to get something online. Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Lindsey Graham, again, your president. All of them, all they do is score cheap, empty political points. It's not even worth scoring, because what happens is these rabble rousers, emotional, hateful leftists, young people come online and dispute it, shoot it down, poke holes in it, and expose them. That's all that's happening. But the response is supposed to be, hey, that's a good job, what you're trying to do in destroying the country. Please, may I have another? Why is that the response to someone that's aggressively attacking our systems? I don't understand it. And it's mean and angry to respond to them. That's how you get nothing done. And I don't know. And sadly, it looks like we're headed for a little bit more of the same.
Yeah, and probably because, of course, I mean, look, Biden wanted you to believe that he was going to sort of be a continuation of Obama. I believe that whether he was saying that or not, that he was going to be. But anyway, look, we talked about a little bit of speculating about the connection between what Obama is saying and sort of the politics of today, the actual activism and all that. But he makes it much more explicit in this next section. So Hamby asks, you write about when you were a community organizer, and a lot of the folks in the communities you were dealing with really just cared about modest change. They want to do better for their families. Let's hold for one second there. Look, I wasn't there with Obama when he was a community organizer. I've never been a community organizer, so I will say he has more experience there. But I find it a little bit hard to believe that as he's talking to all these families who back then, remember, this is pre-ACA, desperately needed healthcare, their wages weren't going up, all of that. We just want modest change. No, don't go crazy. No, not too much. We want the minimum wage to go, but no, keep it down a little bit. We want a little bit of healthcare. Just modest. Who's asking for modest change?
Come on.
And that's a serious question from an Emmy-winning journalist to a former president of the United States, implying that millions of people suffering out there in the working class, they just want modest change.
Yeah, no, you know why? Because sometimes people who, I don't know, you said is an Emmy winning reporter or interviewer. A lot of times, especially when you're speaking to someone like Obama or a major figure, there's this like deference to want to make sure that their interview is comfortable. So with the way you pose these questions is to make sure that they don't even get uncomfortable. You don't want them to bristle. You don't want them to be cornered, even slightly, even accidentally. You don't want to accidentally ask a question that'll make them go, well, even that, because that means they have to think a little deeper. They have to find the way around this to actually explain themselves. And then you worry, oh man, I really just put the former president in a bad spot. He's going to hate this. I'm going to look so bad. Like all that is going, I believe, this is my speculation. All that I believe was going through his head in making sure he made this question as palatable as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, and tried to frame it like maybe Obama did describe it as they just want modest change, and he's just trying to give Obama what Obama wants to make him comfortable. But anyway, it gets more specific. So let's continue with that same question from Hamby. If you're a young activist today and you believe really passionately in a slogan like defund the police, what is your advice to that activist? Knowing that a lot of politicians won't go near that phrase, even if the nuts and bolts of the idea might be popular. Obama, it's interesting. Yeah, but is it? Okay, so look, he says more than that, but that's his immediate response to the way that that was framed. They just believe passionately in a slogan like defund the police, because that, after all, is just a slogan.
That's all it is.
All these people have been organizing around the country all year for a slogan. It's not a reality that they're trying to fix, it's not a suite of changes, it's a slogan. But here is Obama in video responding to that question with a little bit more detail.
I guess you can use a snappy slogan like defund the police, but you know you've lost a big audience the minute you say it, which makes it a lot less likely that you're actually going to get the changes you want done. But if you instead say, let's reform the police department so that everybody's being treated fairly, you know, divert young people from getting into crime. And if there's a homeless guy, can maybe we send a mental health worker there instead of an armed unit that could end up resulting in a tragedy? Suddenly, a whole bunch of folks who might not otherwise listen to you are listening to you. So the key is deciding, do you want to actually get something done, or do you want to feel good among the people you already agree with?
Okay. Again, his entire two terms were effectively, do you want to get something done, or do you want to like try to work inside of the establishment and it's all going to work and everybody's going to wake up and all that? Well, we know how that went. But anyway, JR, what do you think about his thing about the snappy slogan?
Okay, there's snappy slogans that, you know, and you're going to turn people off. That's politics, by the way. There was I remember there's one snappy slogan. It was called hope and change. That turned off a lot of people. Yeah, that turned off a lot of people. And trust me, they didn't like you even though you said hope and change. There was another one, yes we can. There was a lot of people who hated that slogan because they hated you. So every snappy slogan is gonna end up turning off people politically because they just don't like you or they don't like what you stand for. But why are we concerned with those people? You know who's not concerned with what we think? People who have slogans like fake news. That turns off a lot of people. Do they care? Mm-hmm. Deep state. That turns off a lot of people. And they say, look what the deep state's doing. That turns us off all the time. How come they're not concerned about turning us off? There's another one called a thin blue line, and that's in support of murderous cops. That one turns off a lot of people. They're still doing it. Lock her up. I remember that one. That turned off a lot of people. I still hear them say it. There was this another one where they said, send her back. Send Ilhan Omar back to her country. That was a snappy slogan. It caught on at some rallies. There was one more. It was called Jews will not replace us. That was a snappy slogan. No one pushed that one back, did they? No, this president supported those people. When are we going to start criticizing the people that supported other snappy slogans that turned off people? There's one more really good snappy slogan that I remembered. It's called Black Lives Matter. These same people that don't like defund the police also don't like that stupid snappy slogan, Black Lives Matter. Are we going to stop using that one? Are we going to stop using that one now because they don't like that one either? Because they said all lives matter, not just the black ones. And they purposely misinterpret the meaning of it the same way that they purposely misinterpret the meaning of defund the police. So please, the snappy slogans are always going to be there. You're going to come up with another one next time Biden comes in and gets inaugurated. Mm-hmm. So no more disputing snappy slogans to worry about turning off a-holes. I don't care. A-holes are already turned off. I don't need any more care about what they feel. What they feel is opposition to the betterment of this country. So I have nothing to say to them except shut up and get out of the way. Yeah. One more snappy slogan? How about shut up and get out of the way? They're not going to like that one either.
No, maybe they'll like build back better. Snappy slogan. Anyway, so look, it's a reporter talking to the president. The president hasn't changed in any way effectively in like the last 4 years, still thinks that we're still back in that pastime. He's better than some of them. He doesn't think we're in the Reagan years, but he definitely thinks we're still in the first year of his presidency because he doesn't get what the Republicans are. Speaking with a reporter who's not going to challenge him, he's going to present everything in a really friendly and easy to digest way for a centrist. But what Obama just said right there is, so at the end of the day, what do you want to get something done, you know, or do you want to engage in this thing that makes you feel better and it's snappy or whatever? Okay, so you don't like that, obviously. So you're implying that the other side is getting something done. So let's rewind then. And go back before all these protests, because those were counterproductive. They were a waste of time around snappy slogans. Okay, so what was the Democratic Party doing to fix all these problems before all that? What? I don't know. Apparently they were trying to get something done. Was the country talking about it then? Was it a major thing that people were suddenly wondering, can we fundamentally rethink how policing works? Were they doing all that? And like, I know he's not talking about the Green New Deal there, but this same conversation was happening with that. It's too crazy. It's too crazy. Like, you're too emotional. You're gonna spend too much money. Do you really want to get something done, or do you want to talk about a Green New Deal? So what were you doing before then? Like, here is what happens basically. The actual lifeblood of the Democratic Party, if it's gonna have any, is gonna be these stupid, pointless, counterproductive young people with their snappy slogans. And they bring up these things that fundamentally change how America thinks about these topics, whether it's criminal justice or it's the environment, and gets them thinking about the possibility of real change. Now, is that attacked by the right? Yes, in both cases, whether it's All Lives Matter or if it's defend the police or it's attacking the Green New Deal, the right is going to attack that. You know why? Because this is politics and that's gonna happen. So in theory, what could happen is that the non-Republicans could strike back in some way, come up with a better snappy slogan if you want, or defend the one that we have. But instead, what happens? They tear it down. So at the same time that the left is being attacked by the right, they're also being backstabbed by centrists like Barack Obama and others who are like, you're going too far, you're making people uncomfortable, corporations won't like it, and all of that. And still, it's our only chance. Even being attacked, beset on all sides, it's our only chance of actually addressing these crises. Imagine what we could do if people like Barack Obama, with his whole fan base and everything, what if he said that the police need to be fundamentally changed? What if he said we need to have a Green New Deal? We might actually succeed.
But let's also remember this, by the way, before even the ACA came in, the fight was over whether or not we have health insurance at all for people, yep, at all, without it being just privatized, at all. A one Rush Limbaugh said, hey, if I get into some kind of accident, it's like $15,000-$20,000. That's fine. That is the kind of conversations we had beforehand that we were just fighting over. Now we're just fighting over whether or not we should, how far we should have this socialized medicine that now that they've demonized in that way too, calling the ACA that as well. So let's not forget where we've come from and the things that we've pushed. And yes, even the progressive things that Barack Obama has partially done because he was getting so much pushback from other people. Let's not forget, he knows more than anyone else the kind of opposition he gets from very basic, minimal change that he was looking for. So yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's yeah, I got that done and I feel good about it, or if it's that was too hard and it was hard enough for me and I can't imagine anyone else having the political capital to do it. I'm not sure what the motivation is, but we're working from a very much zero, a ground zero starting point when it came to even things like the ACA.
Yeah, I'm gonna slightly modify Eddie O'Donnell's comment in Twitch. He went from yes we can to but should we? And really, like, Obama knows, he knows what his 2008 campaign was. What was his, 2008 campaign what you just saw there? Or was it a little bit closer to defund the police and the Green New Deal? Not those things specifically, but the possibility that things could change. And not being constantly terrified of how Laura Ingraham is going to frame your argument, because you're going to try to frame it, you're going to push for it. Now, we do have a response to those comments from Obama, the snappy slogan and all of that, from people who, it turns out, are not just excited about a slogan, they actually care about the substance and want to do something about it. People like Cori Bush, who tweeted, with all due respect, Mr. President, let's talk about losing people. We lost Michael Brown Jr. We lost Breonna Taylor. We're losing our loved ones to police violence. It's not a slogan. It's a mandate for keeping our people alive. Defund the police. Ilhan Omar says, we lose people in the hands of the police. It's not a slogan, but a policy demand. And centering the demand for equitable investments and budgets for communities across the country gets us progress and safety. AOC, we don't have this as a graphic, but she said it just recently, said, what if activists aren't PR firms for politicians and their demands are because police budgets are exploding, community resources are shrinking to bankroll it, and people brought this up for ages, but it wasn't until they said defund that comfortable people started paying attention to brutality. The thing that critics of activists don't get is that they tried playing the polite language policy game and all it did was make them easier to ignore. It wasn't until they made folks uncomfortable that there was traction to do anything, even if it wasn't their full demands. And by the way, like she's 100% right, there's more in the thread, you can see it on her Twitter. Fox has already explained how this works to us. In the initial weeks and months of the protests, they were saying, well, come on, just like be peaceful and be quiet. Be something they can ignore. That's all it is. Absolutely. You don't get change that way. It's pretty self-evident. The only way you get change is by not going and protesting on a little corner really quietly and not really asking for much. That's the only way that this has gone as far as it has.
There's always a suppression of the level of activity and anger you're supposed to have. If people take to the streets and buildings get burned and cars get flipped, it's, you know, don't go on the streets, you're destroying property, you're destroying your communities. What you need to do is go through the political system, vote, get out there and vote, as this guy challenges the entire election system. Yeah. Get out there and vote, get out there and support, campaign, knock on doors, community organize. We tell them to do all these things, and then if people go ahead and follow those orders and decide to quietly go do those other things, then they get, as you mentioned, ignored, shoved to the side. Remember they made fun of the community organizer title? He's just a community organizer. No matter what you do, you suck. They will say that. You suck. So why are we still trying to chase this person, these people, with absolutely no intention of validating your point of view? That's not their job. Their job is to invalidate you, and they will continue to do it. And if you go along with them, you're invalidating yourself.
Yep. Jim Jordan isn't your friend, and he's not going to be your friend. Ted Cruz is not waiting for a reasonable offer, because that's not what he gets paid to look. It's not like, and look, Barack Obama was president. He's obviously much smarter than me. But we kind of do have to explain these things, because fundamentally the people who are still in power in the Democratic Party still don't get it. They still think, oh, Louis Gohmert, he doesn't want anything like socialist, that's all. No, that's not all. They're crazy people. But the thing is, they're also unpopular and they don't really win national elections. So maybe we should do something, because our ideas are more popular. Even as snappy slogans as they are, and they're so radical, they turn off so many people, Biden still got more votes. Maybe we should deliver for those things that have been driving the political conversation for the last few years. Okay, for a long time, I've been saying that if Donald Trump had just given a damn about the pandemic, he would have won election. But what do I know? I'm not like his campaign manager or anything. But it turns out his former campaign manager believes the same thing, because here is Brad Parscale on with Martha McCollum, and here is the mistake he thinks Trump made that lost him the election.
Why not try to make a bigger appeal to some of the women voters who had maybe changed their mind or maybe had been turned off by some of the president's actions? You know, why not try to drive up the Catholic vote, for example, which the president lost some ground on this time around?
1-2% possibly we lost of suburban families, right? The men and women in the suburbs, Philly suburbs, Atlanta suburbs. I think that goes to one thing. And I think it was a decision on COVID to go for opening the economy versus public empathy. And I think a young family with a young child who were scared to take them back to school wanted to see an empathetic president and an empathetic Republican Party. And I think that, and I said this multiple times, and he chose a different path. And I don't think anything's wrong with this. I love him, but like, we had a difference on this. I thought we should have public empathy. I think people were scared. I walked around this people and watched people walk around me. Not like 2 years ago, and they just don't walk next because I'm Brad Parscale, but walk around me because I got a mask on now. They just don't want to get COVID. I can see how waitresses stand a little farther from the table. People are scared. Mm-hmm. And I think if he would have been publicly empathetic, he would have won by a landslide then. I think he could have leaned into it instead of run away from it.
So it sounds like you think that was the biggest error, empathy over COVID.
Policy error.
JR, what do you think about that?
I mean, I feel like you said something similar, that it would have been pretty easy for him if he just did one to two things that at least like faked like he cared about the American people. So there's truth to it, especially since considering the fact that the number of votes that he did get, even though he literally gave a middle finger to the, not literally, but gave a middle finger to the entire country and said, it is what it is. Really? Yeah. Well, I'm safe. You're not. Like, it was constant how much he told the American people, I just don't care about you. Hey, you're on your own. He openly said it. So, and they still voted for him in this large amount. So they still would have had those hateful people voting for him and some certain percentage of people who somehow got fooled by him the first time to think that he really gave a damn about anyone. It would have worked.
Yeah, I think even specifically what he is talking about there, just being more like showing empathy, I think probably could have won him the election if he had pretended to care. I will point out though, by the way, what Brad Parscale is doing there is, in theory, it's criticizing the president, which is something, although he's going to backtrack in just a moment. So let's give him some limited credit for that. And saying he made a mistake on COVID. But do you notice the mistake that he's saying he made? Like, he focused on reopening the economy rather than showing empathy. Okay, but like there's kind of another element, maybe stop people from dying. Like, he keeps saying he could have shown empathy. Okay,
yeah.
I want empathy, but I also don't want my grandma to die. Like, he didn't acknowledge that the massive death toll had anything to do about it. The only thing he seems to believe is you could either have a mountain of corpses or a mountain of corpses with Trump sitting on the top saying, I'm really sorry about this. No, you could have less corpses. That's a possibility. Maybe you could have not pursued a strategy that resulted in needless tens of thousands of Americans dying off into the future. It's still, that strategy is still going on, by the way. But he doesn't acknowledge that that's a possibility, that less people could have died. And Martha McCollum's follow-ups don't say anything about the death toll. Because again, it's still Fox, and they have to pretend that people didn't die. And if they did die, it's probably their fault. And it was probably Bill Gates, it has nothing to do with COVID. You don't know about COVID.
Yeah. Well, that was a step too far. You can't say, you know, let's stop people from dying because you don't care about people. You're supposed to just give the bare minimum, which is say you're sorry. That would help. And it honestly, again, it would have. That's not, their brand is not to help people. Their brand is to act like they care.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, like I said, he still wants to be in good with Trump, especially considering all of his troubles in his personal life. So he can only criticize him so much. So very shortly after, he goes back to talking about Trump in the dear leader sort of way. So here is Brad Parscale on Trump.
There's also things he did great. It's hard to see that now when things are so close, but you know, he built one of the greatest economies in history. He wouldn't have been close if he wouldn't have been that far. I still think he's gonna go down as one of the greatest presidents. I think he got one choice away from being perfect. And that was, do I want to open the country and be the economic, or do I want to be publicly empathetic? And I think it goes right into thing, because this is one of the most empathetic men when you're right, when you're sitting next to him, he cares about you, asks about your family, all that stuff. All you do is get on stage and do that.
Yeah, I mean, he was kind of right about what Trump could have done to win, but he's a crazy person. He's a crazy person with a very, very small face. But anyway, more importantly, he's like, he made one wrong choice. Trump did. Okay, Brad, thank you for acknowledging that he should have shown empathy, but that's crazy. You're a crazy,
you know, because
person.
He shows his empathy, you know, because if you stand there next to him, he'll ask you about your family. That's it? Really? That's it? You know, I ask people all the time, hey, how you doing? I don't listen when they tell me how they're doing, because honestly, I don't care how they're doing. It's just one of those niceties that humans say. That's not just me, by the way. I'm not just trying to show you guys how much of a mean person I am. But if it's just some general random person and you're president of the United States, you're not going to, you don't really care what Joe Williams in Iowa, his issues are right then. You just, especially this guy, you really don't. You're supposed to take their stories and use them for yourself. That's what politicians do.
Yeah.
Now, I know I'm painting with a broad brush. Politicians really don't care what each individual person says to them. Sorry, I'm sure some do at lower levels, but when you're at this level, it's just how many of these types of people can I coalesce to make an argument for myself? It's a it's a selfish game. It really is. And it's supposed to not be, but that's just not what we have anymore. So
yeah.
He asked how your family is, so that shows how much of an empathetic great guy he is. You remember Herschel Walker at the RNC? He said there was this one time Trump showed up at Disneyland. I took his kids and mine to Disney World or something. And you know what? Doggone it, Donald showed up. He was there. That's the congratulations that he showed up where his kids were and hung out with you when you took his kids to an amusement park. Oh, he's a good guy. I didn't think he was gonna show up. And he showed up. What an incredible guy. He showed up with his kids. Oh my God. That's
some
the
people have low bars for, yeah. Yeah, and by the way, so you say that he asks about your family. Okay, but let me ask Falk, but does he ask specifically about like the 14 to 20 year old female parts of your family, or is it more broad than that? Because one is kind of endearing, the other not so much.
We've definitely heard stories about that. Yes, we have.
Yeah, let me give you one more really sad part of this, because of course Brad Parscale, who used to be like the Grand Moff on the Death Star, is now reduced to this. Brad Parscale said he and Trump haven't had any contact recently, a silence that left Parscale emotional during Tuesday's interviews. Quote, "It is pretty hurtful, but it's probably just as much my fault as his. I love that family, and I gave every inch of my life to him. Every inch." Every inch of my life isn't an expression. What are you talking about? Yeah. But anyway, it's probably my fault that he doesn't talk to me. What, you're prostrating yourself on the mainstream media to get him to talk to you. No, you're trying. I think it's his fault. I think he doesn't want to talk to you.
This is brutal. Wow, again. Yeah, it comes back. This is such an abusive relationship. No matter what he does to you, or how he treats you, or how much he ignores you now, it must be my fault. Yeah, sure, he made fun of me. Yeah, sure, he called me names. Yeah, sure, he ousted me. Yeah, he potentially destroyed my career. But it's probably my fault. Really?
It's so sad. It's so sad. Never I want to be specific. There are politicians that I like, that I would like to have on the show, but we haven't talked in a while. It's their fault. Because I want to talk to them. I didn't do anything wrong. It's their fault. Anyway. For what feels like a month now, Joe Manchin has been needlessly feuding with AOC, just constantly attacking her because the sort of people that he wants to appeal with hate AOC. So let's take you back a little bit and then we'll give you the update. So he touted his role as a centrist lawmaker is back, you know, during the election, who sees a quote golden opportunity to bring the country back together and to work in the middle, which as we've been talking about, that doesn't work. It hasn't worked. It's not gonna work. And there's nobody in the country that wants you to talk more about working in the middle than Mitch McConnell, Ted Cruz, and all of them who are gonna try to stop literally anything from happening over the next few years. But anyway, last month he drew the ire of Ocasio-Cortez and others after a set of efforts to redirect police funding, defund my butt, which is a weird way to put it, admittedly. But at least it did lead to my favorite tweet in the history of Twitter, which was AOC tweeting just this photo of her back at Joe Manchin, which is the best. Which is the best. Anyway, and I would tell her it's the best, but it's not my fault, it's her fault. Anyway, so he responded with, "I guess she put the dagger stare on me. I don't know the young lady, I really don't. I never met her. I'm understanding she's not that active with her bills or in committee. She's more active on Twitter than anything else." So first of all, I would love to say things to Joe Manchin that I am not allowed to based on the format that we're on. I can't say those things, but she said, "I find it amusing when politicians try to diminish the seriousness of our policy work, movement organizing, and grassroots fundraising to she just tweets as though serious politics is only done by begging corporate CEOs for money through wax sealed envelopes delivered by Raven." And yes, that is my second favorite tweet ever now because of the Game of Thrones reference at the end. But that is true. So we're gonna have some numbers. We're gonna actually compare them. But JR, what do you think about this feud, first of all?
Yeah, it's gonna. First of all, that whole line when he said, "I don't know the young lady, never met her, but my understanding is that she doesn't do anything else but tweet." That's virtually what he said. Where'd you hear that from, Joe? I mean, you know, if we're interviewing someone and you say such a direct statement about someone that you've never met, never talked to, don't think about that much. How do you know all this about her then? Who told you that she doesn't do anything else? I'm just curious. I mean, by the way, Joe Manchin comes off as this soft-spoken, nice guy. This is what he thinks he comes off as. It's what he tries to. Soft-spoken, nice guy who speaks with this tone of, "Well, you know, Bill, what I just want to do is just make sure that everything is great for our nation, and I just represent the people of West Virginia." No, but when he wants to be, he can be vicious. Sure, yeah, he can try and demean someone in their positioning and actually what they do for the country. There's also times when he had his little back and forth with Donald Trump But I'm gonna get to that in a minute. I'm gonna let you continue.
Okay. Now, in terms of the actual numbers, because after all, she doesn't do anything. She just tweets or whatever. Lauren Hipp, a spokeswoman for Mrs. Ocasio-Cortez, said the congresswoman had submitted more amendments than 90% of other freshmen, including those promoting fair housing and a tear gas ban that passed the House, and had missed fewer votes than Mr. Manchin. Specifically, back in 2019, he missed 1.2% of all Senate votes, ranking him in the middle among many fellow senators as far as votes missed. During that time, she missed only 0.3%. She co-sponsored 553 bills, compared with his 423, and both of them put their support behind 11 pieces of legislation that went on to become law. And by the way, like, so she's higher numbers or the same for these things, but let's bear in mind, she just finished her first term as a congresswoman. He's a senator with a lot of experience, a lot of connections, a far bigger staff and all that, and understandably higher expectations that he'll actually deliver. So lagging or just matching her is not a draw in this case. He's actually slacking. But she spends too much time on Twitter. I'd argue based on these numbers, she's earned a little bit of time on social media. What is he doing? Seriously, what is he doing with his time? Because he's still talking about her. He could have tweeted it, he did it in an interview, but instead of talking about legislation, he is talking about her after all.
Yeah, so that's the way this guy operates. And we're talking about people tweet too much again. Let's bring up the president of the United States, the biggest tweeter in the world, gotta be honest. This guy.
Other than Neera Tanden. She tweeted more, but anyway.
Is he concerned about what the president's always tweeting and not getting anything else done? Because by the way, the things that the president has gotten done, executive orders, shoving things through, intimidation, appointing people up, people in positions that don't get confirmed, just make them like the temporary head of some department. All those things that he does that don't actually go through the normal portals of our systems. Is he have a problem with him? Because right after Joe Manchin, to his credit, did vote to impeach to continue on with the impeachment trial with Trump. Trump got very angry, called him Joe Munchkin, and said the people of West Virginia aren't going to forget this. You're going to lose. And when Manchin won, he relayed this conversation that he had with Trump. Or Trump very nicely said, oh yeah, I knew we couldn't beat you, but I mean, it wasn't for a lack of trying, Joe. And Joe and he had a nice laugh. Yeah, you tried to beat me, huh, Donald? Oh, yeah,
you tried to end my career.
This is crazy.
Absolutely, give you what you want.
That you can laugh over and tell Fox News about how awesome it was. But then when AOC has something she actually wants to say and actually do for the American people, all she does is just tweet. It's weird how he only sees tweeting when it comes to someone who he opposes versus someone he doesn't oppose, which is Donald Trump. Yeah. He also boasts about how he votes for Trump all the time. Now, lastly, there was one other point when they asked him before, as the reelection was coming, and Joe Manchin decided to say, well, there's a possibility I could still endorse the president. The same president that you voted to continue impeachment hearings on, you're willing to potentially endorse. His reasoning was, everybody can change. Maybe the president will change, you know? Maybe that uniter will come out versus the divider. Really? Did that work out yet? Is someone gonna follow up from him? Hey, back in February, Joe, you said that maybe this new uniter might come out. Did that happen? Do you regret saying that? Do you regret propping him up? Do you regret giving him any kind of legitimacy after he attacked you multiple times and then you laughed about it? Yeah. Is there anything about his Twitter account that you want to talk about, Joe? No, because he likes the president. And no, because he thinks he can continue his political career in West Virginia by supporting the president and promoting him and propping him up. AOC doesn't help that because he's not interested in the same things that AOC is interested in, which is the American people.
Yeah, he wants another term. He's going to get another term. What does he want it for? What is he going to do the next 6 years? He's going to stop stuff. That's what he's going to do. People come up with ideas like changing up police funding and stuff like that, and he stops it. That's it. She comes in to do things, he comes in to stop things from being done. And there are way more of the stoppers than the doers. Two last thoughts on this. Referring to someone as a young lady, does it have to be misogynistic? Theoretically not. Is it in this case? 100%.
Absolutely.
She's a congresswoman. Okay, you can call her Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez. That's what you can call her. She's not a young lady to you, okay? And she's getting more done. And by the way, the other thing is, and I just learned this from JR. On February 9th, how did I not know this? 4 days after my birthday, on February 9th, Trump did indeed tweet, they are really mad at Senator Joe Munchkin in West Virginia.
Absolutely. Sure did.
He called a senator Joe Munchkin. How did I not do the whole show on that day? That's so crazy. It's not, is it funny? Kind of, but not as a slam. Munchkins are cute. That's such a deeply weird thing to do. That is a really, really bizarre thing for a person to do and to leave up. 17,000 people liked it so much, they retweeted the Munchkin thing. Anyway.
Well, all okay. I'm saying is good thing that's the weird. Uniter came out instead of the divider.
Yeah. Yeah. Could it have been autocorrect? No. It's Trump. It's definitely not autocorrect. It's definitely, he thought, he was sitting there, he was getting ready to wipe, and he thought, I'm going to call him Munchkin. That's what happened. I'm not going to give you any more details on that context.
I was about to go in further detail, and I shouldn't.
No, we should not. Okay. Anyway, JR, as always, thank you for taking us through this JR Wednesday. Great to have you on.
Love it.
It was. Maybe a little bit too much.
I'm gonna jump on the PS4 and play some Inner Banks really fast.
That's not what it's called. Anyway, I'll see you later, JR. Thank you again. Friend of the show and reporter for The Nation, Ken Klippenstein, is a bit of a FOIA hound tracking down information that those in power don't want you to have. In this case, they really don't want you to have it because they're blocking his efforts to find these documents. So now he's taking them to court. Ken Klippenstein joins us now on the program.
Great to be back in the Thunderdome.
Good to be here. Good to have you here. And so you are actually suing the Florida Department of Law Enforcement in regards to them effectively stonewalling you, correct?
Yeah, that's right. When you know, I do a lot of open records requests. FOIA is the federal one, but every state has its own interpretation of that. And as you pointed out, you know, in theory, the law is great. Public records were generated by taxpayer dollars. You know, they depend on the consent of the governed, so they belong to us. You know, pursuant to some exemptions for you know classified information, personal information, that kind of thing. The problem is that they found all sorts of ways to get around that. And to not give us the records that belong to us that we, you know, paid our tax dollars for, that we, you know, give them our consent to govern over us in exchange for, and that's not good, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So you're trying to get information in particular about what subject in this case?
In this case, it's DHS's Fusion Center affiliate. So this is a very interesting part of the national security world that isn't talked about very much. After 9/11. George Bush issued a series of executive orders established the Department of Homeland Security. And part of that was also establishing these things called fusion centers. The idea is it's fusing national level intelligence between DHS and FBI and you know other agencies like that with local law enforcement. So you're sort of seeing this is kind of a parallel thrust towards giving local law enforcement more and more resources of the sort that we've seen reported for years now. I mean, they're getting DOD equipment from the military. They're literally getting stuff that was intended and earmarked for Afghanistan and Iraq and using domestically. Well, also local law enforcement is getting intelligence that these very fancy three-letter agencies in the intelligence community have that they're getting shared with them. And I think that we should know what that intelligence is. And so when I you know, submitted an open records request in Florida for their fusion centers intelligence, specifically with respect to the George Floyd protests, the other protests, all the protests happening this year, you know, the you know, amid pandemic and everything, and anti-police brutality protests, they refused to give me anything. And so, you know, we have these agencies working with these federal agencies that have, let's say, not great civil liberties histories. And so I'd like to know what it is they're getting from them and how they're using it. They won't say. So we took it to court with my attorney, Beth Borden. You know, she has a Patreon that I would encourage people to consider supporting. Even just a few dollars helps a lot because these cases don't actually cost an enormous amount of money. It's just that, you know, it does cost a little bit and that ends up making it prohibitively time consuming and expensive for activists. And unfortunately, then we're in a situation where only corporations can afford to litigate these things, whether it's big newspapers like the New York Times or just businesses that litigate these things for commercial purposes. And then the public doesn't get to find out what they want to know.
Yeah, and look, I mean, if people have been watching the Damage Report for some time, they know your track record and what you've been able to deliver. This is the way that that's done. And so it's great that you have legal representation that's looking into this particular case. Now, this isn't your first lawsuit. If we go way, way back to a couple weeks ago, there is another one, correct? Against, in this case, the Chicago Police Department.
That's right. I'm also suing the Chicago Police Department for the same records. I want to know what intelligence are they getting from the FBI, potentially DOD, all these other, you know, three-letter agencies. And how are they using that to track Black Lives Matter, to track the George Floyd protests? Same answer. Sorry, we can't give it to you. This is sensitive law enforcement information. Now, I'm not disputing that there's probably some of that in it, but to not give me anything, you at least give the person the piece of paper and blackout, redact the portions that you know, maybe are disclosed confidential informants or, you know, sensitive law enforcement methods and techniques. But that's going to be a portion of the document. You don't just say, oh, we're not giving you anything. Come on, you can at least give me an entirely blacked out piece of paper. Where are we that I can't even get an entirely, inked out document? I mean, that's what it used to be like, and it's not even like that anymore.
Yeah. No, look, I get the concern over Florida, but are you implying that Chicago police might have done something wrong in regards to these protests?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Chicago police history, I mean, you're being facetious, but they have a very ugly history with respect to, ethnic minorities, civil rights movement, so on and so forth. I mean, I would encourage people to just Google Fred Hampton and find out what happened there.
Yeah.
If you want to know a little bit about Chicago police history. So yeah, these concerns are not coming out of nowhere. I have guys in law enforcement telling me, look at this stuff, find out what's going on here. You're going to find something. And, they're always cagey in terms of what they'll tell you. But I'll say this, I've never had a FOIA lawsuit that wasn't found in my favor. I'm very confident that these will be. And so that money is going to go towards giving people these documents to tell them what the hell these agencies are doing.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, admittedly, probably a stupid question. So you've had lawsuits like this before where they've tried to block you, or they've taken forever and like made it really slow.
Right.
Others have too. We don't know exactly how either or both of these are going to turn out, but based on your experience and the experience of other people in these sorts of situations, does this tend to be the sort of thing where the police are just being overly defensive and keeping their cards close to their chest? Or does this generally result in something that'll be at least relatively spicy?
Absolutely defensive. I mean, I wouldn't have taken it to court if I had any question about it, because if they find against you, you end up paying, in many cases, the police department's attorney fees. And we don't want to get in that situation. So this is something I'm very confident that we'll be able to win. And moreover, as you said, we have great laws on the books, but it's their implementation that is the problem. And so we have a de facto situation where they'll give you stuff if it's sufficiently innocuous and not going to embarrass them. But they'll either slow walk or just not give you things that they don't want out there. I mean, the problem is there's no oversight of these agencies other than the courts. There's no mechanism to hold them to account. Say, are they? I mean, we're letting the fox run the hen house. They decide what gets disclosed from their own records. So what do people think is going to happen when that's the state of play?
Yeah. And by the way, for anybody watching, I mean, I know that this sort of topic hasn't necessarily been the biggest news story for a little while. We're in the wake of the election and everything. But bear in mind, like throughout this year, we've had drone, tracking of these protests. We've been having cops finding people, like going to find people in the streets and tearing them off the streets, shoving them, in the backs of vans and things like that. There have been any number of different abuses in these areas. So God only knows what a big city like Chicago could be hiding. So definitely something that people are going to want to support if they want to get to the bottom of that. The link is available there. We'll put it in the description as well. But as always, Ken, we appreciate the work that you continue to do, both in and out of the courtroom.
I really appreciate it, man. And I really appreciate all the donors. We're already starting to get things back. And without them, we wouldn't have been able to do that. So it's cool to see, maybe we're not in power, but there's a lot of people that are sympathetic to, what we want to get out there.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you again.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.